Well, I don't think it'll take the whole time to finish up this chapter, but we got to slide 18, which I haven't mentioned yet, or I've mentioned anything about yet. What we see here is that there are two categories of contractions in skeletal muscle. And those two categories are isometric and isotonic contractions. Now, I should preface this by saying that contraction linguistically means getting shorter, but we use the word contraction when we're talking about muscles just really to mean the generation of force, whether that muscle is getting shorter or not, because muscles generate force and try to contract, but depending on what the load is, the muscle might not actually shorten. All right. So when you're exerting your muscles, that's what we call contraction. Sometimes it's actually shortening, sometimes not. All right. So isotonic means equal tone, right? And last time I mentioned muscle tone as being the level of excitation that a muscle is undergoing, and even at rest, there is what we call a low-level muscle tone. So tone refers to force, really, the force generated in a muscle. And isotonic, therefore, means equal force, whereas isometric means equal length. And here's where you first have to understand that contraction doesn't necessarily mean shortening, because therefore, isometric contraction literally would be nonsense, right? So isometric contraction is muscle contraction that happens without the muscle changing in length. And this occurs posturally all the time, for instance. To maintain a posture, a muscle has to contract to just exactly equal a load so that you don't tip over one way or the other. That muscle isn't getting shorter, but it's working continuously just to stay that length so it doesn't get stretched by the load. And so that's isometric contraction. The other major kind of contraction, isotonic, is broken down further into two types. That's why there's A, B, and C here and not just A and B. So B and C are both isotonic, meaning that the force generated by the muscle during that isotonic contraction is about the same. Of course, it's not perfectly identical throughout that time, but isotonic means equal force. The two types of isotonic contractions, as you see, are concentric and eccentric. Now, concentric contraction is what you would probably think of if I just ask you to describe a muscular contraction. In isotonic concentric contraction, the force remains about the same during that contraction, and during that time, the muscle shortens. In other words, what's happening is that the force generated, the muscle tone, is greater than the load. The load is a force that's trying to oppose the load by the muscle, the force by the muscle. And if the muscle wins out, it's more force than the load, then the muscle is going to get shorter. That's isotonic contraction, or concentric contraction. Eccentric contraction is still isotonic because the muscle is still generating the same amount of force throughout that contraction, but the muscle actually gets longer rather than getting shorter. And this is just the opposite situation. In this case, the load, whatever it is, exceeds the force generated by the muscle. And so the muscle gets stretched by the load. It just doesn't get stretched as quickly as it would if there were no force being generated in the muscle. If the muscle were at rest, the load would just quickly extend the muscle. All right, so you can see the pictures here being illustrated. Isotonic eccentric contraction is what you're doing when you slowly bring a dumbbell down rather than just letting it, just completely relaxing your muscle and letting it flop down. Okay. Another example, though, of eccentric contraction is when you descend a staircase. When you put your weight on your limb, you are catching that weight Now you're bending your knee, right? But what you're really doing, you're not using the muscle that would flex your knee, which would be your hamstrings muscles. Instead, you're trying to catch that weight. You're trying to extend your knee, but you're not extending it so much that it actually is greater than the force of your body, right? So you, when you put your weight on that, on your foot, you're trying to keep that knee from bending so quickly by straightening it out, but not straightening it out as much as your weight is trying to bend it. It's another example of eccentric contraction. Well, both of these happen at the same time, basically, or during one use of a muscle, which is what's illustrated in slide 19. So notice that early on, the left part of this time graph, there is an isometric phase. And notice that the y-axis, this is really a double graph. So for the red line, the y-axis is tension. For the blue trace, the y-axis is length. And during the isometric phase, by definition, the length in blue is not really changing. It's long and it's staying long during this isometric phase. This is when basically you're building up tension in the muscle. You have to overcome those elastic elements, take up the slack, like I was saying. But also if there's a considerable load, you know, like if you're trying to lift a dumbbell, you can feel yourself exerting against the weight of the dumbbell before it ever moves, right? You have to keep exerting until that exertion exceeds the actual weight of the dumbbell. That's when you finally shorten your muscle and lift the load. Well, that's the isotonic phase. And in that case, notice the blue trace is coming down because the muscle's getting shorter. But you've maxed out on the tension. So the tension, the red trace, remains about the same. That's isotonic. Now on to 20. We need to talk a little bit about muscle physiology, muscle metabolism more specifically. We've already talked about all the things that happen inside the muscle cell at the molecular level that leads eventually to contraction, starting with that neuronal action potential and ending with actual contraction of the sarcomere. And remember that ATP was absolutely necessary for this. What did we need ATP for? Well, ATP gets hydrolyzed in order for its energy to be useful. But what is ATP actually used for directly? The hydrolysis of ATP cocks the myosin heads. That's correct. But even before that happens, what does ATP accomplish? Well, yeah, it is used for all the pumps that we've talked about. But I'm talking about at the actual myofilaments. The ATP has to come along before it gets hydrolyzed, right? And when it comes along and binds to that myosin head, what happens as a direct result of that? What is it?
It shortens?
No. It doesn't flip the head until the head is... that happens next. But what do we need ATP for in terms of the junction, in terms of a cross bridge? The ATP's energy has already been invested in a cocked myosin head. There's no ATP at that point. At that point, the cocked head has ADP and inorganic phosphate connected to it.
You mean breaking it down?
Yes. Breaking what?
The cross bridge.
Right. ATP actually breaks the cross bridges. It's not needed to form them, it's needed to break them. And that's why I said last time that explains rigor mortis. Because without the ATP, you can't break those cross bridges that had already formed during life, and therefore the muscle is locked in that position. But That doesn't spend the energy of ATP. The spending of the energy of ATP comes when ATP is hydrolyzed by that the enzymatic domain of that myosin head. That's what splits it into ADP and inorganic phosphate. And ATP is familiar to probably all of you already as an energy-carrying molecule. It's one of many energy-carrying molecules. And different energy-carrying molecules do different jobs in the cell. ATP is the most versatile, but when it comes to this contraction mechanism that we're talking about, this cross-bridge formation, no other molecule will do. It has to be ATP. So skeletal muscle contraction absolutely requires ATP in that cross-bridge cycling that we've discussed. The thing is, there's not very much ATP in a muscle cell if you think of spending it. There's enough ATP in a muscle cell for drastic exertion of that muscle, vigorous exertion, only for a couple seconds. That ATP will run out if that's all that there were there. That's not all there is, though, which is why you can sprint more than a couple seconds. But you can't sprint indefinitely, right? When you start sprinting or doing any really vigorous exercise, you are drastically increasing the amount of ATP that's required compared to when you were just sitting there. And there is some ATP available, of course. But like I said, that gets used up almost immediately within seconds. Now, since ATP is absolutely required, that means in order to go beyond a couple seconds, the ATP needs to be replenished. Now, you're replenishing ATP continuously in your cells using cellular respiration. Cellular respiration is aerobic in us animals, and it's a way of getting useful energy out of fuel molecules, the food you eat, basically, and store that some of that energy in the form of ATP molecules. You do this by taking a partially spent molecule, energetically speaking, which is an ADP molecule. You can think of ATP as being kind of like a debit card. A debit card has some useful spending power to it, right? But not infinite. You make a purchase with a debit card, and it's no longer as valuable because you've spent some of that money that it represents. But you can make a deposit and bring it back to its full spending potential. You can do the same thing with an ADP molecule, which you can think of as a partially spent ATP that was, by sticking a phosphate back onto it. It's lost a phosphate. That's how you got energy out of the original ATP. To replenish it, you need to stick a phosphate back onto it. All right? Well, cellular respiration accomplishes that much more efficiently than any other process. Now, cellular respiration occurs after a process has already occurred in the cell called glycolysis. Glycolysis, which literally means the splitting of sugar, takes the master fuel that's used in all cells, glucose, and splits it into two molecules of pyruvate. That releases some bond energy. And some of that bond energy is captured by glycolysis and used to phosphorylate a couple ADP molecules into ATP. So you get some ATP molecules from glycolysis, which happens before cellular respiration. At the end of glycolysis, though, there's two pathways that can be taken biochemically. That pyruvate can be dealt with anaerobically or aerobically. meaning in the absence or the presence of oxygen. It's definitely worth it in terms of energy payoff from the original fuel molecule to go down the aerobic pathway, cellular respiration, which is what happens in the mitochondria. Because for that same original glucose molecule, really what's left of it, the pyruvate, cellular respiration will allow for the making of about 16 times as much ATP as the two that were made just by glycolysis. And this is how we're able to be animals that idle so high. We're endotherms. We produce our own body heat because we are aerobic. All right? To do that, we require a lot of energy, we have to be aerobic to do that. On the other hand, if oxygen is not available, the other pathway will automatically be taken. That other pathway is anaerobic, and it's called fermentation. It's not respiration. Fermentation really doesn't make any additional ATP. The 2 ATP that glycolysis made is all you get under anaerobic conditions. Fermentation really just deals with that pyruvate in a way so that more glycolysis can continue to happen. So you continue to just make 2 ATPs for every glucose that you process versus about 38 if you do it by cellular respiration. Thing is, the anaerobic pathway doesn't rely on oxygen. The reason that cellular respiration requires oxygen is because in order to process all that energy and make those additional ATP, you have to have somewhere where to put the things that you strip from the fuel, which are hydrogens that came from the fuel. And a hydrogen atom is a proton and an electron, right? So when you strip these protons and electrons from the food, which is how you get the energy from those food molecules, those have to be put somewhere. In cellular respiration, that final thing that accepts those electrons and protons is oxygen. And that's exactly why the oxygen that you breathe, once you add hydrogens to them in the form of a proton and an electron at a time, you do that twice, you're adding 2 hydrogens to an oxygen, you make water. That's why water is on the right side of the summary equation. You make water out of the oxygen you breathe, the hydrogen that gets put into that water came from the food you ate. And that's how you got the energy out of that food. All right? Well, you don't need that. Cellular respiration requires oxygen for all that to happen. If oxygen is not available, then the whole process backs up and you have no choice but to go the fermentation route. So, if you start sprinting and you run out of your ATP almost immediately, like I said, you are going to make additional ATP, not right away by cellular respiration so much as by fermentation. And that's because you can only deliver oxygen to the muscle cells at such a high rate, depending on the person. Because it relies on blood being perfused to those tissues, pumped by the heart, and the oxygen has to be picked up by the lungs. So this is why you start breathing very rapidly and your heart is beating very quickly during a sprint. You're trying to deliver oxygen at a rate fast enough to keep up with the demands for cellular respiration. The thing is, if you're actually sprinting, going all out, you're never going to be able to keep up with that. Your heart and lungs cannot keep up with that, which is why you can't do it indefinitely. On the other hand, if you are jogging, as long as you have fuel to burn, you know, your heart and lungs can keep up with that oxygen demand, and you can do that indefinitely. Okay, so notice on this timeline, this just represents a sprint, that aerobic respiration using oxygen from myoglobin is listed first. What is myoglobin? Well, it's a pigment molecule, very similar to hemoglobin. Hemoglobin is a pigment in the blood, and each individual hemoglobin molecule can carry up to 4 oxygen molecules. So 0, 1, 2, 3, or 4 oxygen molecules. A myoglobin molecule is similar, except it carries either 0 or 1. And it's not in the red blood cells, it's in the skeletal myofibers, the muscle cells. So when oxygen is plentiful and you're not sprinting, what you're doing with some of that oxygen that gets delivered from the blood is you're loading myoglobin molecules inside the red blood cell, inside the skeletal myofibers. And they're storing a little bit of oxygen, basically. Okay? So as soon as you start sprinting and oxygen demand is not met by the circulatory system, then the myoglobin will dump its oxygen off and give you a little bit more. But that doesn't last very long either. Next is the phosphagen system. Phosphagens are molecules that are carrying phosphate. They are storing phosphate by having phosphate hooked to them temporarily. And then when ATP demand goes up, because you're spending the ATP and turning it into ADP, the phosphagens can hand that phosphate that they're carrying off to an ADP to turn it back into an ATP. In other words, you don't have to go through the long biochemical pathway of cellular respiration or even fermentation. You just immediately make an ATP from a phosphagen. You can't use the phosphagen directly for the muscle cells because it has to be in the form of ATP. But the phosphagen can be handed, the phosphate can be handed off from the phosphagen to an ADP molecule to renew it quickly. Glycogen lactic acid system. This is fermentation that I was talking about. Now, glycogen, what is glycogen? In terms of organic biomolecules, what kind of molecule is glycogen? What are the 4 types of biological macromolecules? Polysaccharides, nucleic acids, lipids, and proteins. Which of those 4 is glycogen? It's a polysaccharide. It's an example of what we call a storage polysaccharide because it's a polysaccharide made for the purpose of storing energy. Any polysaccharide is a polymer of monosaccharides, right? A bunch of them hooked together. In the case of glycogen, every one of those monosaccharides is glucose. But it's glucose that have all been stuck together to be in a more compact form. The liver, one of the major jobs of the liver is to make glycogen, but muscle cells are also able to make glycogen. So when you have extra glucose on hand, right after a meal, for instance, right after you absorb that huge amount of glucose that's coming in, more than you need, the liver will take some of the glucose out of the blood to keep the level lower than harmful, and it will incorporate those into glycogen molecules, but the muscle cells are doing the same thing. So you have what are called glycogen stores in your muscle cells. The production of those glycogen molecules out of glucose is called glycogenesis. Okay, glycogenesis. Just the opposite of glycogenesis, in other words, instead of the production of glycogen out of glucose, we have the breakdown of glycogen into glucose again. That is called glycogenolysis. Right? Literally, lysis of glycogen, splitting of glycogen. So, that's what this is referring to, this glycogen lactic acid system. Glycolysis, which is the splitting of glucose, right? That's what makes you the 2 ATP by fermentation. You have to have glucose for glycolysis. You can't use glycogen directly. But if you need glucose for fermentation quickly during this sprint, a glycogen molecule can be broken down by the muscle cell into individual glucoses again. And then those glucoses can enter glycolysis to be split into 2 pyruvates each. That gives you your 2 ATP by anaerobic fermentation. All right? Now, eventually you're just going to run out. You can't indefinitely sprint. Because you fatigue, basically. Under anaerobic conditions, your muscles fatigue. And for a long time, we thought that the major cause of fatigue is that in animals, what's produced as a result of fermentation is lactic acid or lactate. That's what the pyruvate gets turned into in this process. It's turned into lactate, which doesn't give us any more energy, but it's necessary in order to keep glycolysis happening. Well, lactic acid, of course, is an acid. And if it builds up, that means that the pH is going to go down. Remember, low pH means high acidity. And whenever you perturb or change the value of the pH, that can have a drastic effect on the shape of proteins in general, including enzymes and other kinds of proteins. When you change the shape of a protein, you change its function, because proteins have their functions because of their shape. This is why we, as part of our homeostasis, we make sure we keep pH in narrow limits, otherwise we die. So we thought, well, a buildup of lactic acid, obviously that's going to acidify the tissue, and that can start interfering with all kinds of things. But really, on closer inspection lately, with more real-time studies, what we're seeing is that's probably not true. The lactic acid actually gets swept away from the muscle just as fast as it's produced. It has to be sent to the liver, which then deals with that lactic acid and turns it back into usable stuff. So that's probably actually not part of fatigue. What seems to be major causes of fatigue is that every time a muscle cell is stimulated by all the mechanisms we've already talked about previously, there's some leakage of potassium ions into the interstitium or into the extracellular fluid, including the extracellular fluid that fills the T-tubules. Because remember, the lumen of the T-tubule is really outside of the cell, right? When you leak a bunch of these positive potassiums, that actually changes the membrane potential from where it would normally be at rest, and it makes it harder to stimulate, harder to get it up to threshold. So the action potentials that are trying to be created aren't as effective, basically. That's part of it. And there's also a buildup of inorganic phosphate, because when you use your ATPs, those hydrolyzed ATPs get turned into ADP and inorganic phosphate. So a big increase in inorganic phosphate really is a sign that you are using a lot of energy in the form of ATP at the moment. Well, that buildup of inorganic phosphate actually starts interfering with mechanisms inside the muscle cell, including the release of calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum and the binding of calcium and so on. So that's also probably a major part of fatigue. But because of fatigue, your brain will just force you to shut down. You might want to keep sprinting, but you will not be allowed to by your own brain. And what you've either experienced or you can easily imagine this, you get done with a sprint until you collapse. You don't just sit down and resume normal breathing like you did before you started sprinting, right? Your heart's going to beat for a long time after that, even though you're not really doing anything but sitting there. You're going to breathe very deeply for a long time after that. And that's because you have to pay back what we call the oxygen debt that has accrued during that time of exertion. Okay, so the lactate that builds up, like I said, needs to be dealt with by the liver. Dealing with that lactate requires energy that's expended by the liver, which means the liver is going to need for that moment, or for however long it takes, to produce more ATP in its own cells to deal with this this lactate that build up in the muscles. When you have to make more ATP, that means you have to run your mitochondria more, because because that's where cellular respiration is happening. And cellular respiration requires oxygen, so if you're doing that at a greater rate, you're going to have to supply the tissues with more oxygen. So it seems like your body is still busy, because it actually is. It's no longer busy in terms of the muscles shortening or contracting. It's now busy metabolically to deal with all the stuff that is building up during the exertion itself. Once the oxygen debt is paid, then as long as you're not exerting yourself again, you're back to normal breathing. All right, in 21, we're looking at how these ATPs can be made very quickly. I've talked about the phosphagen system. So notice on top we have an enzyme called myokinase. Myokinase is one of many different kinases that are used by cells for different reasons. So a kinase is a general term. It's a category of enzyme types. Kinases are enzymes that phosphorylate other things. To phosphorylate something means to stick a phosphate onto it. Okay? So if you're going to build an ATP molecule by sticking an additional phosphate onto an ADP molecule, that is phosphorylation of the ADP to produce ATP. And an enzyme that phosphorylates something else is called a kinase. In this case, myokinase gets its name because myo means what? Muscle. Right. So you can imagine if the ATP that you had in very short supply, but you have ATP at the ready when you start the exertion. As soon as that gets spent, now what you have is a bunch of ADP instead, and not so much ATP. Well, an ADP and another ADP can cooperate, because the one ADP can lose one of its two remaining phosphates and stick it on to the other ADP to bring it back up to ATP. Myokinase is just the enzyme that makes this happen a lot quicker than it would happen without the help of the enzyme. So you can see that happening. ADP is getting turned into AMP, adenosine monophosphate. It's being dephosphorylated so that that phosphate can be passed with the help of myokinase enzyme to another ADP, phosphorylating it into ATP. Because ADP does not work for muscle contraction. That cross-bridge cycling requires ATP, not ADP, even though ADP is still carrying some energy. Right? So that's a way to quickly get ATP back up. And ATP in any given cell, not just muscle cells, undergoes a huge amount of turnover. The amount, you know, if you were to think about having a certain pool of ATP that just gets spent in a day, but you can't replenish it, that ATP would weigh more than your body. So you don't have all that much ATP, but it's always being turned over. As soon as an ATP gets spent into ADP, it gets replenished into ATP, and it gets spent immediately again doing something. Hell of a big turnover rate. And this is how it can be turned over so quickly in muscle cells without actually having to bother with fuel, because this is a storage of phosphate in the form of ADP. Okay, it's just a transfer of phosphate. Well, the other one is a transfer of phosphate from a different molecule, which is creatine phosphate, which is also called phosphocreatine. They mean the same thing. Creatine is something our cells are able to make out of amino acids. And a creatine molecule can carry a phosphate. And as long as it's carrying the phosphate, really what it's serving as is a phosphate storage device for when that phosphate is needed to turn an ADP back into ATP quickly. All right, that's what's happening here. And this requires the help of a different enzyme, creatine kinase. Notice that it's a kinase again. And the way it's working here is that creatine phosphate is carrying the phosphate originally, storing it. Now the muscle needs it in the form of ATP, so the phosphate gets stripped off the creatine, producing just creatine on its own. The phosphate gets transferred to ADP to make ATP. That's the phosphagen system. All right, now 22, let's discuss different kinds of muscle fibers in a skeletal muscle. There are so-called slow twitch or slow oxidative fibers, and there are fast twitch or fast glycolytic fibers. Now, slow and fast fibers are well named because slow twitch fibers take a little bit more time for that force to be generated. They don't produce their force as quickly as a fast twitch, obviously. And one of the reasons is that slow twitch are oxidative. They require cellular respiration primarily for the source of the ATP. And that takes a lot more time than just fermentation, which is anaerobic. Glycolysis by itself, glycolysis and fermentation are just using glucose only for those two ATP that I talked about. That happens much more quickly than if you go through the additional process of cellular respiration. You just don't get nearly as much energy out of it. So fast twitch are glycolytic, meaning they rely on glycolysis primarily and not additionally cellular respiration, whereas the oxidative ones rely on glycolysis and then cellular respiration, both. Well, there's all kinds of differences between these other than that. As you see here, you tend to find slow twitch in smaller motor units and fast twitch in larger, so very powerful muscles tend to have large motor units, and they tend to be involve a lot of fast twitch fibers. Now, these categories are for individual cells, myofibers. But a whole muscle, which is a lot of myofibers in parallel, right, is really made up of both kinds. So there is a ratio of fast twitch to slow twitch fibers in any given whole muscle. But some muscles have a very high proportion of fast twitch. Others have a very high proportion of slow twitch. And since the slow twitch are oxidative, that means they are absolutely tied to a continuous oxygen source. That means they need to be very highly perfused with blood. So there's all kinds of capillaries around them to bring oxygen being carried by that blood to these cells that need that oxygen. And that blood delivers oxygen to myoglobin inside those cells, which will store that oxygen a little bit for them, like I was talking about. Well, the blood itself, the capillaries, plus the myoglobin that's in the cells makes these fibers reddish. Right? It's just like blood is red because of hemoglobin. Fast or slow twitch fibers are red because of myoglobin. Whereas fast twitch fibers, which don't rely so much on cellular respiration, do not have such a blood supply, and they don't have as much myoglobin, and they therefore are paler in color. They are whitish. So this is the difference, if you happen to eat animals, between red meat and white meat. White meat has a lot of fast twitch fibers in it, not so much myoglobin, whereas red meat has, or dark meat has, a bunch of slow fibers in it. And depending on where they are in the body, that can be explained. For instance, on a chicken, which are not long distance flyers, right? They can fly a little bit, maybe to save their life. It's kind of a glorified jump, but they do it for a couple seconds, they fly. Well, that breast meat, which controls those wings, is white meat, right? It's primarily fast twitch. Whereas if you look at a long-distance migrating bird that flies over the ocean, and nonstop, obviously, its breast muscles are going to be dark meat because it's a marathon runner, not a sprinter, basically. Notice also that these differ in their fatigability. Now, slow twitch has the disadvantage that it takes a little bit more time to operate, hence the slowness, but it has the major advantage that it doesn't fatigue because it's operating aerobically, and therefore all these things that lead to fatigue that I was talking about don't happen so much. Fast twitch is nice in that it will get you going very quickly, but it can't keep up for very long, and it's going to fatigue, because it's going to fatigue. I'm not going to exhaustively read these to you because I mentioned most of them, but those are the major fiber types. Well, not only do we find different ratios of slow to fast twitch fibers in whole muscles on different parts of the body, but it's also true that individuals have the ratio of fast to slow twitch fibers in a given muscle within an individual is genetically determined. By the way, a fast twitch fiber doesn't turn into a slow twitch fiber or vice versa. Whichever it is, it's going to be that way for your life. And so, because of genetics, it actually is literally true that there are natural born marathoners and natural born sprinters. Some people are born with a higher than average proportion of slow twitch, and those are going to be your people who are predisposed to being good marathoners. If you are an elite marathoner, you're going to suck at being a sprinter because you don't have those fast twitch fibers in your muscles. But if you are a born sprinter because you have a high proportion of fast twitch, you're going to suck at being a marathoner. And it doesn't matter how much you train, you're not going to change that ratio of the fiber types in your muscle. That was genetically determined. So that's what this is showing you in 23. 24 now. We've been talking almost exclusively about skeletal muscles. And remember, those are the only muscles that make up what we officially call the muscular system. But this isn't really so much about an organ system, this chapter, as it is about muscle tissue. And there are those two other types of muscle tissue, cardiac and smooth. This gives you a nice comparison of the three. And we've talked about several of these things already. Of course, they're located in different parts of the body. The skeletal muscles connect via tendons to bones, whereas cardiac muscle is found only in the heart. And smooth muscle is found several different places, mostly lining hollow organs, like the uterus, the alimentary canal, or digestive tract. But also in the skin, we've already talked about erector pili muscles, those muscles that pull on hairs for piloerection or horripilation. Those are smooth muscles as well. In the lab, we've already talked about the histological differences, right? Skeletal muscles are multinucleate, and they are extraordinarily long set for cells, for individual cells. And that's because, as I said, they start as individual cells that line up, each with its own nucleus, and then those multiple cells fuse together to form one long skeletal myofiber. Now, the word myofiber can refer to any of these individual muscle types, as long as you're talking about a cell. But myofiber is most descriptive of skeletal muscle cells. Another word for a muscle cell is a myocyte, right? Literally meaning muscle cell. And those words are usually more often used rather than myofiber when we refer to smooth or cardiac muscle, because they're not nearly as long. Similarity between skeletal and cardiac histologically is that they are both striated, and that's because they're both formed out of functional units called sarcomeres. Those Z-discs are what give you the striations. The subcellular machinery, the interaction between actin and myosin in a smooth muscle has a different arrangement. There aren't sarcomeres, and therefore there aren't striations in smooth. In terms of cell shape, cardiac myofibers or myocytes are cylindrical. They don't taper at the ends, but they are branched, whereas skeletal muscle cells are cylindrical and unbranched, just one long tube or cylinder. Smooth muscles, on the other hand, are what we call spindle-shaped. They taper at the end, so each end comes to a point and has a more fat middle. By the way, cardiac and smooth muscle are also mononucleate, like normal cells, at least most of them, just have one nucleus. like a run-of-the-mill cell. In terms of how they work, there's major differences as well. Skeletal muscle, as I've already described, is under conscious control, so you decide to have those muscles move, to contract them, in other words. And excitation of a muscle cell does not happen unless a neuron tells it to fire. So without the neuromuscular junction, skeletal muscles would do nothing. They don't contract on their own. On the other hand, smooth and cardiac muscle do contract on their own. They have what is called autorhythmicity. So that's not to say, though, that they aren't innervated. Both cardiac and smooth muscle is innervated. There are neurons that connect to those muscle cell types. But those connections are not necessary for contraction. What the neurons do in cardiac and smooth muscle is either speed up or slow down the contraction. They modulate it, in other words, but the cell can contract by itself. Also, smooth muscle can contract in response to several different kinds of stimuli. Not just electrical stimulation, but being stretched, for instance, can cause it to contract. Certain chemicals can make it contract, so hormones can cause it to contract, and so on. Whereas for a skeletal muscle cell, you have to have an action potential. Smooth muscle uses action potentials in certain cases, but that's not the only way it can contract. Action potentials are not actually necessary in smooth muscle to cause it to contract. One thing that we haven't talked about is calcium with respect to smooth muscles. We've talked about calcium's important role in skeletal muscle contraction, and since cardiac myocytes also are formed of sarcomeres, it's really about the same thing in skeletal muscle. So there is the troponin molecule, or troponin molecule that I talked about already. That's happening in that's involved in skeletal and cardiac muscle. But smooth muscle uses a different mechanism. So for calcium source, first of all, since smooth muscle does not have a very extensive sarcoplasmic reticulum, it doesn't have very high inside storage of calcium, like the other two muscle cell types do. But remember that calcium is always in greater abundance in the extracellular fluid than the intracellular fluid, which is why it also comes into the neuron before the muscle's action potential is actually created. That action potential reaching the end of the neuron, remember, directly causes the influx of calcium, which is what spurs the exocytotic release of acetylcholine. Remember this stuff? So calcium is always has a gradient favoring the diffusion into a cell. And in the case of smooth muscle, since there isn't much storage of calcium in the sarcoplasmic reticulum, the major source of the calcium coming into the cytoplasm is from outside the cell, extracellular fluid. When it gets there, though, it doesn't encounter troponin molecules like it does in the other two cell types. In smooth muscle, calcium binds to a different thing called calmodulin. When calcium binds to calmodulin, that basically activates that signaling molecule, which then activates an enzyme listed right beside it called myosin light chain kinase, another example of a kinase. And myosin light chain kinase is what does the job of allowing for cross-bridge formation. Okay? So it's a different mechanism in smooth muscle compared to cardiac and skeletal. Those are the ones I wanted to... Oh, no, gap junctions. Gap junctions I mentioned a little bit before. We see gap junctions between adjacent cardiocytes, or cardiac myocytes. You know, when one cylinder, one cell ends, and the next one is butted up right against it, that is an example of an electrical synapse formed by gap junctions. What do we call that whole anatomical region, where the two end-to-end cardiac myofibers join. Not synaptic cleft. There is. Oh no, that's for skeletal. That's this neuromuscular junction between a neuron and skeletal muscle. We're talking about two cardiac muscle cells butted end to end, and this is an electrical synapse, not a chemical synapse, because the action potential traveling down the first cell is immediately going to travel to the next cell. So there's only one action potential rather than, like it is in the skeletal myo or the neuromuscular junction, the neuronal action potential ends, that releases a chemical, and the chemical then eventually causes the start of a new action potential in the muscle cell. So what are these places called where two cardiac myocytes meet? Yeah. Right, intercalated discs. Intercalated discs, which you can see on a microscopic slide as little dark bands, those feature the gap junctions that allow for the ion flow that is responsible for continuous propagation of action potential from one cell to the next. Well, we also have gap junctions in we don't have gap junctions in skeletal muscle, but we also don't have gap junctions in smooth muscle. Those intercalated discs are for cardiac myocytes alone. Okay, let's take a look at some cartoons of skeletal muscle. Smooth muscle, sorry. 25 shows you an example of what's called single unit smooth muscle. In a little bit, I'll describe the difference between what's called single unit and multi-unit, but it's smooth muscle. You can see right away that it's different in appearance. It's not striated. That's why it's called smooth, by the way, because it doesn't have these little ridge-looking striations. You can see that the cells are tapered at their ends, but also this neuron looks different from a motor neuron that innervates a skeletal muscle. What we have here are axon terminals, collateral axons branching from this main axon. And by the way, this is a different part of the overall nervous system. The somatic motor nervous system, which is a branch of the overall nervous system, is what serves skeletal muscles, all the skeletal muscles. Somatic motor nervous system. The autonomic nervous system, which is another branch of the nervous system, is what serves both cardiac and smooth muscle cells. So this is a branch of an autonomic neuron, and notice that it has little enlargements in its axon, which are called varicosities. A varicosity or a varix, V-A-R-I-X, means an enlargement along the way of some more or less cylindrical item, like a vein, for instance. An abnormal enlargement in a vein is a varix, and we therefore call that vein a varicose vein, meaning having varices, the plural of varix. Well, this is an abnormality. These are normal varicosities, but it's still called that for the same reason. Little enlargements here and there. These enlargements are not the same as synaptic knobs, like we saw for skeletal muscle. But these varicosities do release neurotransmitter from vesicles, just like a synaptic knob does. It's not a specific release, though. Notice that there's many varicosities, and they're not just associated with a single muscle cell. Each one is not associated with a single muscle cell. So it's a general release of neurotransmitter, and it basically just it bathes the surrounding region. And therefore, several different muscle cells can receive that signal and start to contract more. We don't see the inside in this picture, but we will in a couple more pictures. We're almost done with the chapter. But first, let's look at 26. this shows you just a typical part of the body where you find a bunch of smooth muscle. This is a cross-section through part of the alimentary canal. This happens to be the lower part of the esophagus before you get to the actual stomach. But you would see a similar arrangement actually no matter where you cut along the alimentary canal. Beyond the stomach, in the intestines, or wherever, you would have multiple layers. So there is a muscularis mucosae, which is smooth muscle surrounding the actual epithelium that lines the lumen, but you also have layers more superficial to that. A circular layer, which has a grain in it that is circumferential, so that when it gets short, it makes the circle smaller. This allows it to squeeze the lumen. And a longitudinal layer where the grains are longitudinally arranged, and when that gets short, it will bunch the tube up, make it a shorter tube. And a combination of the action of these two muscles is what propels the contents of the alimentary canal along its way. Food in the esophagus, once it's in the stomach, we call it chyme. That gets propelled peristaltically by the action of these muscles through the small intestine. By the time it's in the large intestine, we no longer call it chyme, we call it feces, and then it's out of the body. But a typical appearance of smooth muscle in hollow organ, lining a hollow organ. Okay, now to 27. Here we see the difference between single unit and multi-unit smooth muscle. They're both smooth muscle, but multi-unit smooth muscle is a little bit more similar to skeletal muscle in that these varicosities are associated with a single muscle fiber, rather than the varicosities in single-unit muscle are just generalized. They're just releasing neurotransmitter to a population of cells, not to just one cell at a time. And therefore, there are what correspond to motor units in a multi-unit smooth muscle, depending on which neuron fires. It's not just basically affecting the whole group of cells. It's affecting a single motor unit within that group of cells. Still don't see the internal architecture, though, until 28. So 28, we can see myosin myofilaments, which are very similar to how they look in the thick filaments we looked at in skeletal muscle. But they just aren't members of sarcomeres. There aren't any sarcomeres in these smooth muscle cells. Instead, there are collections of proteins called dense bodies, which are situated here and there, kind of like, almost like spot welds at the surface of the cell. And attached to those are actin filaments in red, running between the dense bodies. And then the purple ones are the myosins. Well, just like in the other kinds of muscle cells, there is interaction between myosin and actin, but it's just arranged differently. So what get pulled on are these dense bodies, because the increase in overlap between myosin and actin that's happening is going to tug on these dense bodies and move them closer together. And this is going to bunch the whole cell up, basically. As it does that, it usually twists as well. So it's kind of like a ringing motion. Ringing of a towel. W-R. Not tintinabulation. So this is a contracted one on B. And one thing I didn't mention when we were on the table that compares the three types, is that skeletal muscle twitch, you know, the contraction of a single muscle, is very quick, milliseconds. Cardiac contraction is much more extended, you know, a major fraction of a second. It has to be long enough of a contraction in cardiac myocytes in order for it to effectively expel the blood from the chamber it's trying to get that blood out of. If it was too quick, the blood would still be in there. It would get compressed, but it wouldn't leave. The force wouldn't be long enough for it to actually be expelled. Smooth muscle is even much longer, several seconds long. It takes a long time to build up the force, And then it takes a long time for that force to be released. So smooth muscle has waves of contraction that you can actually see in the organ, right? When you look at peristalsis, you can see it as a slow-moving wave of contraction. That should do it, because I never read these systems interaction slides to you, but those are useful things to look at for your interest. Now, this was a denser than usual chapter, you probably noticed. I don't know how many of you have taken my advice shown on the bonus page of preparing for my exams by trying to give your own lectures. But first of all, you should do that, because I think it's probably the best way to prepare. Second, I wanted to mention it, though, because this is a perfect chapter to try that out on. Because this is a process that we've been talking about that has a beginning and an end, and things happen in a certain order. That lends itself well to explaining the whole thing without looking at anything. So, for instance, you should be able to go through all the detail between creation of action potential in a neuron and finally contraction of the muscle. Should we go through that quickly?
Yeah.
Okay. You intend to contract a muscle. That creates an action potential in the neuron. The neuron propagates automatically from the cell body of the neuron. The action potential does, I should say. From the cell body of the neuron down the axon and down all of the collateral axons that branch from that, until it reaches the synaptic knob at the axon terminal. The direct result of that arrival of the action potential, which is a change in voltage, opens up voltage-gated calcium ion channels in that neurolemma, the plasma membrane of the neuron. Because of the gradient that's already in place, this causes an influx of calcium ions into the synaptic knob. That releases acetylcholine from vesicles that have already been stored inside that synaptic knob. The acetylcholine is released from the cell into the synaptic cleft, which is extracellular fluid, the tiny space between the neuron and the muscle cell. The little region of sarcolemma just under that synaptic knob is the motor end plate, which is highly elaborated so that it can hold in it a bunch of membrane-bound acetylcholine receptor molecules, which are proteins that not only serve as acetylcholine receptors, but that when receiving acetylcholine, open up their gates and serve as sodium ion channels. Because sodium is in greater abundance in the extracellular fluid and therefore the synaptic cleft, when the acetylcholine binds to the receptors and opens them up, the sodium ions travel through these acetylcholine receptors from the cleft into the skeletal myofiber. All right? That causes a change in the membrane potential of the myofiber. You're bringing in positives, and therefore what was a negative value at rest is becoming less negative. And enough of that happens so that the voltage comes up to that special voltage called the threshold voltage, which is what causes the first action potential in the muscle cell. Once you have an action potential in the muscle cell, which involves voltage-gated sodium ion channels, then that automatically gets propagated down the length of the myofiber in both directions from that neuromuscular junction. It's traveling down the sarcolemma in general, but the sarcolemma includes transverse tubules. They're just invaginations of the sarcolemma. So when the voltage gets transferred or propagated into the transverse tubules, this brings this change in voltage close to the membrane that makes up the terminal cisternae, which are bag-like enlargements of the sarcoplasmic reticulum inside the myofiber. That change in voltage will open up voltage-gated calcium ion channels in the membrane of the sarcoplasmic reticulum, And since the sarcoplasmic reticulum had already been busy spending energy pumping calcium ions from the cytoplasm into its lumen, the gradient is in place for efflux of calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum, from the terminal cisternae, into the general cytoplasm. Once the calcium is in the general cytoplasm, it will encounter troponin molecules of thin filaments. The binding of calcium ions to troponin will change the shape of that troponin, and since that same troponin is anchored simultaneously to tropomyosin and to G-actin of F-actin strands, the change in shape will drag tropomyosin into a position that is such that it no longer, the tropomyosin no longer covers the active sites of those G-actin monomers. Once those active sites of G-actin monomers are exposed, the nearby myosin heads will readily form cross bridges. And as soon as a cross bridge is formed, change in conformation of this energized form of the myosin head will drag actin with respect to myosin. Thick and thin filaments overlap more. There is muscular contraction. And since the thin filaments are anchored at their ends to Z-discs of sarcomeres, the overall sarcomere gets shorter. All right? This will continue to happen as a cycle as long as ATP continues to be available and as long as continued action potentials get sent from the neuron via acetylcholine to that same myofiber. Eventually, the neuron will rest when you say, okay, I'm going to quit exerting now. The neuronal action potential ceases, no longer release acetylcholine. Acetylcholine esterase, the enzyme, will quickly break that acetylcholine down so it's no longer binding to acetylcholine receptors, which means those acetylcholine receptors will now close their gates and they will no longer allow for continued influx of sodium ions. With no more sodium ions coming in, you no longer have a voltage up at threshold. You're back to resting membrane potential, and therefore no action potentials are created because you don't have the voltage necessary to open up those voltage-gated sodium ion channels. When you no longer are sending action potentials down the sarcolemma, you no longer send the signal in the form of a voltage to open up the voltage-gated calcium ion channels in the terminal cisternae, and therefore the pumping action of the sarcoplasmic reticulum, which has been continuing throughout, will remove those calcium ions from the previous excitation from the cytoplasm, put those calcium ions back into the terminal cisternae. That means those calcium ions will diffuse away from the troponin molecules, and those troponins, which are now unbound from calcium, will resume their original shape, and that will put tropomyosin back into a position that blocks the active sites of G-actin. All right? No more cross-bridge formation, and therefore muscular relaxation. Now, if the muscle gets longer, it doesn't do that by itself. It does it because there's still a load on that muscle, some force that will make it longer, and it's no longer trying to undo that load. Okay? All right. Now, remember on the announcements I said that I changed my mind about the practicum, so whether it's Thursday or Friday, you need to bring a Scantron for that, or the same form we do in here. All right.